people. So many people screaming and screaming. And the worst part was, the screams went unfinished. The screams cut out and left me to fill in how they were supposed to continue. In the valley, I listened to an apocalypse that already happened, and I was listening to the end of everything else, and that end would never cease. The callous rush of water didn't stop and continued long past the final echoes of destruction and death. It went on forever. I went along with it, neither cold nor warm, or anything really. Another piece of detritus floating away. Part of me is still there now. At some point I was extracted out of that endless time, and I wasn't in the dark, and I was back at my car and it was almost noon. I don't remember walking back to the car. Trust the process, right? I tell you, Andrew and Eric, there are other gaps in my memory. Gaps I don't care to fill in. I already told you how I tried not to come to New Hampshire, and how I just sort of came back to myself from wherever I was, and I was sitting in a cab on the way to LAX. Just let me tell you this, Andrew and Eric. I wasn't me, or I wasn't all there when the three of us killed Redmond. It was like a trance, I guess, though I've never been in a trance, so how would I know? I think a part of me, the best part, the important part, got sent back to the nothingness, floating along in the never-ending end in the valley. But enough of me was left behind here to see Redmond grinning through his masked face, and to feel the wooden handle vibrate in my hands as I smashed his head, and to hear the sound it made. I wasn't there for all of it. I can't tell you how many times I swung and hit him. I can't tell you which one of us landed the final killing blow. I tell you, Andrew, I already cannot recall specifics about our struggle at your SUV. It's like trying to remember something from early childhood. There's only the barest and broadest traces of this happened and I was there. Eric asks me if I've seen anyone else here or there. He doesn't specify where there is. And he mumbles something about a figure and light. Andrew talks over him, nearly shouting, telling Eric to stop talking to me. And he asks Eric if he's ready to go yet. Eric doesn't look at Andrew. He only looks at me. I try not to stare at his daughter, wrapped in a sheet and on his lap. It only occurs to me now that I'm being a terrible nurse for not insisting I look under the sheet at Wen to make sure she's beyond saving. I tell you, Eric, I've never seen a figure like you described, but that doesn't mean there wasn't one here. Eric says that right before Redmond was killed, he sensed a presence in the room with us. It was sort of like when you drop an egg into a pot of water and the water rises, is displaced. He says it was like that. I don't like what he is saying, and I like how he looks even less. He has a lights are on but no one's home glaze. I wonder if I looked like that when I was talking about my experiences, and I already can't remember how much or how little I actually said out loud to them, or just thought. Eric says he could feel the space in the room being displaced. He says he saw something appear, join the circle around Redmond before we started pummeling him. He says he tried to pass it off as a flash of light from the deck, or a concussion and stress-induced hallucination or migraine. One that looked at him. One that regarded him. Eric enunciates, regarded. He says he hasn't seen the figure again, but he's felt it, hanging around. It was here somewhere after Adrian and Wen died, and Eric says he shut the cabin's front door to keep it outside. I ask you, Eric, is it here now? He tells me no, but he thinks it will be soon. Andrew charges across the room at me. He is crying and yelling, telling me to stop talking to Eric, to stop filling his head with nonsense and lies. To Eric, he says, you're hurt, and whatever you saw was a hallucination and you're not thinking clearly. I tell you, Andrew, I'm sorry, and I'm not trying to convince Eric of anything, and I want to help you both leave the cabin. That's all I want to do now. That's my only mission left in life, to help you both leave here and leave here alive. Leonard says they have to choose again, and soon. His voice is a reveille, and the new part of me that isn't an actual part of me stirs, and I say yes without being able to stop the affirmation. Andrew ignores Leonard, and he tells me to sit in a chair, and if I say another word, he'll kill me. I hold my ground. If Andrew is going to swing that block hammer at my head, so be it. I tell you, Andrew, listen. Redmond's truck is exactly 3 miles away from the cabin, on the side of the dirt road. About halfway between here and the truck, we hid the keys under a flat rock the size of a frisbee. It's slate-colored, and half of it has a light green beard of lichen, and it's maybe 4 steps off the road and into the brush. The rock is in front of a tree, with a goiter-sized knot on its trunk. I don't know what kind of tree, and I tell you, Andrew and Eric, I'm sorry. You can go now and try to find it yourselves, but it'll be difficult to pick out the tree if you haven't seen it before, so I am going to go with you. Andrew says, fuck you. I say to you, Andrew and Eric, the four of us left our phones and wallets in the truck. Leaving the phones and the keys behind was our safety net. We'd decided we couldn't risk having you overpower us, take the keys to the truck and simply drive away, leaving the world to die. Now that's exactly what I'm going to help you do. I believe in what's happening here, but I also don't believe. Leonard says my name like he's a disapproving, disappointed parent, a self-appointed expert, an authority who has none. He tells me to stop talking about the truck and convince them to make the selfless choice. He says time is running out more quickly now. I tell you, Andrew and Eric and Leonard, I don't believe in this kind of God. I pause and laugh at myself. Instead of saying someone or something, I finally deigned to say the G word, haven't I? I tell you, Andrew and Eric and Leonard, I don't believe in this kind of devil either, or in this kind of universe. I'm sure all of them will be disappointed to hear it. I laugh again. And I'm sorry, this is not funny, not in the least. I tell you, Andrew and Eric and Leonard, I don't believe any of this is right anymore. I mean, I never believed it was right or moral, but I thought it had to happen to save the world, no matter what. Now I don't. I am done trusting the process. Eric tells Andrew that he should listen to me, that they should take me with them. I am going to say that after we find the truck, I'll go with them to the police and tell them everything about our four and the kidnapping, and admit to all the crimes perpetrated here, even though I know I will not live long enough to speak to anyone who isn't already in this cabin. I am going to tell them this and more, but Eric and Andrew fall into a shockingly ferocious argument, and they ignore me. I pick up the staff at my feet, the one Redmond custom-made for me, the one with a function that was never explained, but was wordlessly obvious. And it feels right in my hands. And it feels so wrong, I'd be happy if someone cut my traitorous hands off so I could never hold it again. I return to the darkness in the valley. And I'm alone, and flowing away in the nothingness. And I'm alone in the cabin, and the presence in light, or whatever you, Eric, tried to explain to me is nowhere to be found. There's no light. There never was. There's only emptiness and lack and void, and it all explains why the world is the way it is, and I would scream if I could. Andrew, you're pleading with Eric to stop listening to me, to consider that I might be lying about the keys so I can ambush you, that it should be so obvious I can't be trusted. And Eric, you're telling Andrew to let me help, that you believe me, and you need me to find the keys, you need me to get out. I run across the room on feet that do not feel the floor. The curly-cued blade is raised over my head like a banner, a flag, an emblem of death, sorrow, and never-ending violence. Andrew, you tell Eric that you're leaving now and you're not taking me with you. Eric, you see me, sprinting across the room, but you don't warn Andrew. I swing the staff down like I'm aiming to split a log. My torso bends and my legs squat autonomically, so the full force and weight of my body is behind the strike. The edge of the blade smashes into Leonard at the top of his head with a wet smack and a chunky thud. I'm brought back from the nothing, so I can feel the impact reverberate through my hands and arms. Leonard screams, high-pitched and algorithmic, his damaged brain stuck on a wailing siren setting. The shovel blade has sunk into his skull, and I anchor a foot on his lap for leverage to help pull it out. Leonard convulses and thrashes about, and his screams are now a dying prey animal's desperate and betrayed squealing. I finally work the shovel free, and then I swing it horizontally, and I swing it madly, sending the warped blade into his face and his neck again and again. And at the end of it, I'm all me. I am swinging the weapon, and I hit him as hard as I can until he isn't screaming or moving. I pitch the staff behind Leonard. It bounces once and plows into the end table with the yellow-shaded lamp, which tumbles and crashes to the floor. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, I'm sorry. I will never pick up that weapon again. This, at least, has been promised to me. Leonard's face is unrecognizable as having once been a face. His white shirt is only white in spots. I am dizzy, but not dizzy enough to be on the floor. But that's where I am now, on my hands and knees. I pull out his mesh mask from his back pocket and stuff it in mine. Going for the mask is as inexplicable as it is instinctual. Then I root around under Leonard's chair. I find a tooth, and I twitch and flick it away, as though I'd accidentally picked up a poisonous spider. Drops of warm blood drip from Leonard onto my head, neck, and arms. I cough and retch and keep searching the floor until I find the remote control for the television. I stand up behind Leonard. My limbs are tremulous from overexertion, like I'd just finished a hard workout. Leonard's hair is matted and dark with blood and mashed scalp. I tear up, but the tears aren't for him, not really. Andrew and Eric gawk at Leonard, and then at me. I am sorry for your blank, blood, sweat, and tears-stained faces. I am sorry for everything. Eric looks at me, like I'm about to give an answer. Andrew lifts and lowers the sledgehammer weapon indecisively, moving it like a clock's pendulum. I wipe each hand on my jeans, careful to swap hands with the remote and not drop it. As my arm raises on its own, a mechanical arm full of wires and gears that function and perform their duties in secret, I tell you, Andrew and Eric, I have to turn the volume on, but you don't have to listen and you don't have to look at the screen either. My thumb unmutes the TV without having to search the bloodied remote for the correct button. On the terrible screen, the one always filled with apocalypses big and small, breaking news has already interrupted the bird flu program. On the terrible, awful screen is the smoking wreckage of an airplane. The smoke is thick and the deepest black, a writhing toxic column that billows and expands into a cloud, a mass, a tumor in the sky. Quick cut to an aerial shot of the crash site, and debris is scattered in the grassy field like confetti. Quick cut to another wrecked plane, cratered in the middle of another field. There is more black smoke, and within its hypnotic undulations I know there is a message. Then a cutaway to another downed plane, its pieces floating in an ocean only a few hundred feet offshore. The plane's tail section is intact and breaches the surface like the fin of a leviathan. Silver panels from the fuselage bob serenely in the blue waves. If left alone, they will sink, and I imagine them becoming part of a reef, a habitat, a new ecosystem. But of course, that won't happen. Life isn't the promise. Eric stands and backs away from the couch so he can better see the television. He still has Wen in his arms. The paper towel pad taped to the back of his head hangs loosely and is about to fall off. He says what Leonard said yesterday. The skies will fall and crash to the earth like pieces of glass, and then the final, everlasting darkness will descend over humanity. I want to tell you, Eric, to stop saying the words Leonard said. They are not Leonard's words to begin with. The four of us were given them, and you cannot trust who gave them to us. I want to tell you, Eric, to ignore the words and the planes and the blood. I want to lie to you, Eric, and say that you and Andrew can leave the cabin and everything will be all right. I tell you, Andrew and Eric, we should leave now. We shouldn't spend one more second in this place. I don't tell you, I am the last of the four, and I am next. And it will be a relief when it happens. Maybe the truth is, the end has already been happening long before we arrived at the cabin. And what we're seeing, what we've been seeing, is not the fireworks of the world's denouement, but the final flickering sparks of our afterword. The commentator says they have confirmation of as many as 7 airplanes having crashed without warning, without issuing distress calls. Amid fears and increasing speculation, there may have been a coordinated cyber attack on the plane's flight management systems. TSA has yet to issue a statement. Airports around the globe are canceling flights. Andrew swings the sledgehammer, punching a hole in the middle of the television screen. The hole is as black as the smoke, spewing from the planes. This is the end. 7. Andrew and Eric. We can't go on. We stare at the television. The hole in the screen is a porthole in a sunken boat. It's an open mouth, ringed in rows of small, asymmetrical, jagged teeth, and it once spoke of unimaginable places and things. It's a wound. One from which the blackest ichor will begin flowing. It's a telescopic view of the universe before stars or after. In the new silence of the cabin, Andrew only hears his own breathing and the quickened metronome of his heartbeat. He imagines bashing the television and frame with the gore-stained hammer until there's nothing left to bash and until he's beaten back the icy tendrils of doubt. Eric stares at the screen as though he is afraid to look elsewhere. The very act of staring is a talisman that already failed to protect us. He has Wen in his arms and he sways in rhythm with the frenzied buzz of flies echoing from inside the hole. Only one of us ever hears and sees these flies, just as only one of us saw a figure in light. Eric silently tells Wen he will not put her down, or ask Andrew to hold her until after we leave the cabin, even though his arms are tiring. Then he says, "We should go, right now." Is he only saying this because Sabrina suggests we should leave? He closes his eyes and he sees planes falling like drops of rain from a darkening sky. Andrew says, All right, let's go. Maybe I should carry Wen. Andrew hates the defeat and need in his voice. No, I have her. I can do it. I can make it. In his head, Eric prays for the strength to carry Wen until his strength is no longer needed. For a few weeks after her third birthday, Wen went through a phase insisting we carry her on endless jaunts around our condo, so she could count the number of laps as a measure of how strong we were. We would both purposefully complete the same number of laps, which frustrated Wen greatly, and she reacted like we were keeping a secret from her. We would jokingly tell her that our arms were always at the same strength level, and we only got tired because she was growing, getting bigger by the second, as we held her in our faux, shaky arms. Andrew says, I know you can, just let me know. Wen's body is all but made shapeless by the sheet he wrapped around her. He wants to hold her again, right now, and he wonders if her arms, which he carefully positioned at her sides, have shifted or bent, and he wonders what her hands are doing, and her feet. And maybe he should unwrap her and make sure she's okay underneath, and then kiss her forehead and not look at the lower half of her face. Eric says, I will. Andrew is weeping. All right, I'm sorry. For as long as he lives, Andrew will wonder if Eric partly blames him for Wen's death because of his unwitting part in the hellish Rube Goldberg device that took over our lives. Because he snuck the gun up to the cabin, because the gun was in his hand, because his finger was on the trigger, because he couldn't stop the trigger from being pulled. The lump of the handgun, the cold machine, is in his back pocket. Andrew's hands are currently filled with the wooden handle of the cursed weapon O'Bannon made. He wishes to hold Wen instead. Why are you sorry? Eric doesn't know what to say to him. He wants to tell Andrew that he loves him, but is afraid that it would sound final. Andrew doesn't explain and says, I'm sorry, again. He doesn't like how Eric stands, wavers, leaning one way and then the other, or how he talks with no inflection. He doesn't like how inscrutable Eric's eyes are. It's more than the concussion and dilated pupils and the shock of everything. Does he look this way because he has given up? Eric says, I said we can go now. I know, we're going. We say the right words again, but we don't move. We stand there. Now that Sabrina is the only one of them left and unarmed, we are more afraid of what we are thinking and of what the other one of us is thinking. We're afraid for each other, and we're afraid of ourselves. How can we go on? At this shared thought, we turn away from the television screen and away from each other. Sabrina is behind Leonard with a mask stretched between her hands. She pulls it down over the pulpified, eroded mass of his head. The mesh conforms to his new, unrecognizable physiognomy. And the white immediately reddens. His concealed and misshapen head is grotesquely small, a bump atop the mountain range of his broad shoulders and prairie-wide chest, which strains to be contained within the looped ropes. His grisly, trussed corpse is a garish cartoon, a ludicrous exaggeration of the human form. Andrew motions at Sabrina. You and I are going out onto the deck first. Sabrina asks, why? To check O'Bannon's pockets for the truck keys. They're not there. I told you we hid them under a flat rock, and I promise I'll help you find them. She looks at Eric, and her half-smile turns into a wince, as though she's ashamed, guilty to be appealing to him for support. Andrew says, there's no way a wannabe redneck like that would leave behind his truck keys. Sabrina doesn't argue or protest. She walks the line between the kitchen and the common room to the deck and straddles Adrian's supine body as she fumbles with the screen slider, which stubbornly continues to reject its track. "Just take it off and chuck it outside." Sabrina carries the screen door onto the deck and stashes it between the picnic table and cabin wall. Andrew instructs her to stand next to O'Bannon and with her back against the wooden railing. Once she follows his directions, Andrew joins her on the deck. The air is warm and humid, ready to burst. Wind rattles through the trees, and small waves lap at the lakeshore below. The gray sky is a smear, a neuromancer sky, dead and anachronistic. Eric walks behind Leonard and in full view of the doorway so he can see what's happening on the deck. The sun is muzzled, but the sky's grayness is too bright for him. He doesn't hear any birds chirping or whistling, only flies gathering on Leonard's corpse. He tries to drown out the buzzing with silent prayers and entreaties and what-do-we-dos. Planes are falling in his head. One dives into the lake and sinks to the bottom. The water is nothing more than a curtain to be brushed aside. Andrew says, "Lift the blanket and check his pockets." He hopes against hope that the keys are with O'Bannon. If they are, then he will have caught Sabrina in a lie, and it will be easier to convince Eric she and the others have been lying all along, and all this end-of-the-world bargaining insanity is, in fact, insanity. Sabrina peels the blanket up from O'Bannon's lower half. She coughs and recoils from the release of a rancid, cloying fecal smell that brutally imperializes the deck. Andrew reels backward. He holds a forearm over his nose and mouth, a gesture as feckless as building a wall of sand to hold back high tide. Regathering herself, Sabrina is careful to fold the blanket so that O'Bannon's torso and head remain veiled. The bloodstains on his jeans have dried into a hardened crust. On her knees, she searches inside each front pocket, grimacing and grunting, and then turning them inside out. Andrew asks, "Nothing in your hands. Did you palm a key?" Sabrina holds up her empty hands. "Check his back pockets." He's so desperate for the keys to be there, he repeats himself. "Check his back pockets. There's nothing there. Check them now." Sabrina lifts O'Bannon onto his side, and the smell impossibly becomes more intense, more physical, a thing clawing through membrane and matter. Sabrina's eyes water, and her heavy breaths hiss through clenched teeth. She turns her head away from O'Bannon, gasping for clean air. "There's nothing in them. I can't pull these pockets out. You're going to have a look yourself." She balances the body on one hip. O'Bannon's blue jeans have turned inky from an unholy mix of blood and shit. The back pockets appear to be bulgeless and fitting flush against the body. But Andrew can't know for sure if there isn't a single key in them. Sabrina drops O'Bannon's body before Andrew can make up his mind as to whether he was going to stick his hand in either pocket. She twists away from the body and drops to all fours, coughing and dry heaving. Andrew says, "Maybe he tucked a key inside his socks. Check those too. The keys aren't here. Just do it." She rolls O'Bannon's handcuffs over his thick, mottled calves. She sighs and says, "Look, he has those no-show ankle socks on. They don't even cover his..." "Take his shoes off. He could have stuffed one key in his shoe. It has to be on him somewhere." Sabrina shrugs and says, "Seriously?" She's losing her calm, and I just want to help composure, which is fine by Andrew. She'll be more likely to slip up in a lie if she's frazzled and on edge. Sabrina unties O'Bannon's shoes, and she works them off his club-thick feet. "Andrew, we hid the keys in the woods, I promise. I'm not lying." She tumbles the clunky black shoes to Andrew. They clatter and flip and come to rest on their sides. No key comes clinking out. "Go ahead, check them. I haven't lied to you since I've been here, not once." She stands up and recovers the body's lower half. Eric calls out from inside the cabin.
I don't think she's lying, Andrew. I really don't.
Sabrina says, I'll show you where the keys are. It's possible you can find them without me, but I really don't think you will. I'm not saying that to taunt you, it's just the truth. But I'll find them. And then you can leave me there on the side of the road, tied to a tree. Or put me in the trunk and take me with you to the police, turn me in. Your choice. Whatever it is you want, I swear.
What Andrew wants is to have Wen back, and to have Eric be his Eric and not this brain-bashed proto-zombie. And if he can't have that, then he wants to sit down and cry, and never move again. He wants to cover himself with the blanket, the one that used to belong to us, used to be ours. He wants to tie Sabrina to the deck railing and leave her behind forever. He wants to know what exactly is going on in Eric's concussed head. He wants to yell and lash out at Eric for defending anything Sabrina says. He wants to take Wen away from Eric, rip her out of his hands. Andrew says to Sabrina,
All right, back in the cabin, be quick.
Eric asks,
Aren't we going?
Is she coming with us?
I think we need...
We're all going! Andrew yells. That barking roar spikes through Eric's head, and he winces and closes his eyes. When he opens them, he looks past Andrew and to the lake, and a thought scurries. Eric could walk into the water with Wen in his arms, and he could walk until the water is over his head. He could walk until his feet sink into the muck, and then weave binding chains from the weeds so he would never surface, never be exposed to the light. Then everything would be over. He would have made the required sacrifice, and the world would be saved. Aren't those the rules? The rules some growing, metastasizing part of himself believes to be true? There is still doubt, but it has become easier to believe than not. Has it always been easier to believe? Either way, the lake solution doesn't feel right, and it wouldn't be fair of him to take Wen with him, take her away from Andrew. Eric drifts over to the couch and sits down. He spreads his legs wide, balances Wen's body on his thighs, and pulls his arms out from under her to give them a break. He needs the rest, if he is going to carry her for the duration of the walk, however long or short it might be. Flies land on his arms, and not Wen's body this time. He doesn't shoo them away. Sabrina steps over Adrian and back into the cabin. Andrew follows. He sidesteps into the kitchen and grabs an 8-inch chef's knife from the cutting block. He tosses the sledgehammer weapon out the slider doors, and it lands on O'Bannon. Andrew says, Good. With that nightmare stick back with its dead progenitor, the cherry on the top of that refuse pile, Andrew is invigorated and more able to concentrate on what needs to be done to survive the next minute, and hopefully more minutes after that. Andrew stalks back to the center of the cabin's common area, but slows down when there's a hiccuping click in his right knee, a warning from his shifting bones to slow down. He navigates more carefully over the blood-slicked floor. Sabrina stands with her back against the front wall, and Eric is on the couch with Wen's body across his lap. It's as though the trip to the deck didn't happen, and no one has moved and nothing has changed. And just like that, Andrew's energy dissipates, and a near incapacitating sadness and despair swells at the realization that even after we walk out the front door, part of us will be trapped in the cabin and in these positions forever. Andrew says to Sabrina, with his best impersonation of his own stern professorial voice, Turn around, drop to your knees and put your hands behind your back. Sabrina does as is instructed. Facing the wall, she says, You don't have to hurt me. I'm going to help you as much as I can. Eric asks,
What are you doing? I'm going to tie her hands together, and then we'll all walk to the keys.
Andrew saws lengths of rope away from Leonard's bound legs. The size of the chef's knife makes it unwieldy for the job. He accidentally pokes and jabs Leonard's body twice. Red beads leak sluggishly from the puncture wounds like sap from a tree. He manages to cut 4 arm-length pieces of rope loose. He carries them over to Sabrina, who is still on her knees, waiting. He considers threatening her with consequences if she doesn't comply, but instead simply tells her not to move. He squats behind her, his swollen right knee is a bowling ball. Sabrina's fingers and hands are pink with memories of blood. The back of her shirt is as white as a single puffy cloud in summer. Andrew doesn't say anything to her, and she doesn't say anything to him. He does a quick and rough job of tying her hands and wrists together with the first rope length. It will keep her bound long enough for him to take more care with the reinforcement lengths. If any of this process is uncomfortable or painful, Sabrina doesn't react to it. When he finishes, her hands and wrists are all but swallowed up by a thick dual spindle. He tries to pull her forearms apart, and there's no movement, no give in the rope. Eric is off the couch and standing behind Andrew. He looks at the door and is as afraid of what's outside as he is afraid of what's inside. He says, "We're doing the right thing." Andrew does a double take because he thinks he hears, "We're going to do the right thing." He says to Sabrina, "Okay, you can stand up. Do you need help?" "No, I don't." She lifts her right knee until her foot is flush against the floor, and she stands smoothly and without much effort. She turns and flashes a friendly, "I'm on your side" smile that slides into pity, an ugly transformation familiar to us both. She says, "I'm ready." Andrew walks to the front door and swings it open on creaking hinges. Eric holds his breath and prays, asking for the light and whatever entity might be housed within to not be outside waiting for us. That there hasn't been another sighting of the shimmery figure only convinces him it will return. The cabin interior brightens by a few shades, enough to wash out color and add more shadow. This light is from a nowhere time, neither before nor after the golden hours of dawn and dusk. Nothing in the cabin moves. Even Eric's flies are stilled. Andrew stands in the open doorway and glances back inside the cabin. With bent metal pieces of the television frame and wires hanging limply from a splintered, jagged hole in the far wall, and the blood on the floor congealing into colossal scabs, the room was thrashed and scored from within by parasites so greedy as to have killed the host. Andrew waves his knife and says, "Come on." Sabrina is the first to walk outside, and she does so silently. Eric and Wen are next, with Eric walking dutifully and with his head down. Andrew thinks about reaching out to touch his husband's shoulder as he passes, but he fails to lift his free hand in time. Eric is already down the stairs and to the grass. Andrew is the last to leave, and he closes the door behind him, keeping whatever is left inside the cabin from following. It's darker outside now than it was only minutes ago, and windier. The cloud cover is charcoal-tinted. The cabin and surrounding trees block any attempt at distance viewing. At least from the deck, we could see across the lake to the forest and mountains, and more easily imagine the wider world beyond us, beyond what we saw on the television. Without the elevated perspective, the front yard is the bottom of a grasshopper jar. We walk across the lawn and to the gravel driveway. Our footsteps are loud and grinding.
We don't feel safe. We're exposed and vulnerable, and we suppress the urge to run back inside the cabin and hide from this world.
Andrew says, "Hold up," and stops at our SUV.
The passenger side rear door is open, shark-tooth-shaped chunks of glass clinging stubbornly to the frame. The slashed tires have melted into pools of rubber. The vehicle is lopsided, a sunken, derelict ship.
"We can't drive it. It's not going anywhere,"
he says, as though having to explain or excuse leaving behind anything that belongs to us. He opens the rear hatch, which hisses as it lifts over his head. The hissing is a shriek in Eric's ears, and it echoes through the woods, stirring up a susurrus similar to but not the same as the mocking chorus of flies in the cabin. It's a deeper sound, the humming of power lines. Maybe it's a mistake to be outside, attempting to leave, acting like we can simply go on.
Eric asks, "What are you doing?"
"This will be quick." Bullets, those shiny brass threats, are seeds spilled and spread over the black as potting soil trunk interior. Andrew ghosts over the evidence of his earlier struggle with Sabrina, and those leavings now read like tea leaves, a forecasting of the events in the cabin that followed. Andrew pulls the handgun from his back pocket. He studies the snub-nosed barrel from which exploded a bullet that looked no different from the ones lying dormant in the trunk. A bullet that passed through his daughter's...
"Stop it,"
Andrew whispers. He's going to reload this gun and bring it with him, just in case Sabrina or anyone else has another surprise for us. Andrew says into the vehicle's interior, but loud enough for Eric to hear,
"When this is over, and when we are safe, I am going to throw this gun into the woods or the lake, or preferably a bottomless pit. I'll help you find one, and we'll throw it in there together,"
Eric says. It comes out too eager and sentimental, so it feels like such a damned and obvious lie. Andrew reloading that gun, the gun, and then Eric's awkward attempt at commiseration is yet another micro-event within the greater, grander days of horror and evil that will mark us, whether we live another 60 seconds or 60 years, together or apart. Andrew gathers the loose bullets quickly before he can change his mind. They are small, chilled things in his fingers, and he loads the 5 chambers of the handgun. He returns the gun to his back pocket. He places the knife in the trunk next to the gun safe, leaving an offering for a bloodthirsty, violent god, were there any other kind. Andrew faces Eric and is desperate to say something, anything besides, "The gun is loaded, so we can go." Eric adjusts Wen's body in his arms and walks down the driveway towards Sabrina, who is as still as a photographic image. Andrew leaves the SUV trunk open, hurrying to catch up to Eric. His right knee audibly grinds and clicks, and he catches himself as the knee buckles and gives out, leg quivering like a loose spring. Shit. From the mouth of the driveway and standing next to Sabrina, Eric asks,
"What's wrong?"
She sneaks glances at Eric as though she wants to tell him something that's meant only for him. Maybe she wants to tell Eric this is his last opportunity to save the world. Leave Andrew behind while he and Sabrina continue down the road, and along the way Eric can make the sacrifice. A self-sacrifice, without Andrew having to suffer through witnessing his suicide, without Andrew being there to stop him. And once it's done, then Andrew will live. It will be hard, but Andrew will live. And everyone else will live. Eric says,
"Maybe you should."
He pauses long enough, and purposefully, to let Andrew interrupt and to keep Eric from finishing his statement.
"Maybe you should stay here. Don't worry about me. I'm,
rebooting the leg. Andrew regrets not taking one of the weapons with him, as he could have used one as a cane. He walks more cautiously, and with a pronounced sputtering limp, only putting as much weight on his right leg as is absolutely necessary, before skipping back onto his left. He scans the woods along the edge of the driveway for a walking stick, and finds one that's long enough, but might be too skinny to hold his full weight. It's a gnarled, arthritic finger, and the bark is black, knotty, and dotted with green and white blossoms of lichen. It'll have to do. He says, "All set," and hobbles forward. Sabrina calls out to Andrew in an overly cheery, high-pitched voice. "It's not that far. You can do it." And did he see a flash of a smart-ass smirk? The "we're on to you" kind his better students give him when he's playfully obtuse in a group discussion? Sabrina holds Andrew with a look that pins him, and he now reads it as, "I can sprint away at any time, and you can't catch me, and you won't shoot me." Andrew quickens his pace, putting all his weight on his inadequate and warbly stick, desperate to prove he can achieve a brisk, healthy-legged walking speed. He should have gathered more rope and tethered a line between himself and Sabrina. What was he thinking? But it's too late now. There's no going back inside the cabin for more rope. There's no going back for anything. We make a right turn at the end of the driveway. It's darker on the dirt road, which is narrower than we remember, only wide enough for one lane. And it might be our imaginations, but the road appears to be thinning, winnowing as we progress. The trees crowd our procession, wanting to be closer, to hold us, to stop us. They are our jurors, and their whispered deliberations occur above in the canopy. The treetops sway and peer down for a better look, or a final one, before they hold their thumbs down. Above the conspiratorial trees, the clouds have lost their individuality, pressed tightly into thick layers of ash. It's darker ahead, the road leading to a point beyond where we can see, to a point we may never reach. After a few hundred paces of silent walking, the little red cabin is no longer visible. Sabrina is a few steps ahead of us. She walks evenly and with a confidence neither of us feels. We stagger behind, side by side, glancing nervously at each other. Eric looks down at Wen, and another panicked thought slithers in. Later, however long or brief his later might be, when he remembers what it felt like to hold Wen in his arms, will he only and forever remember this death march? It doesn't feel like it's her that he's carrying. This isn't what he wants to remember, and her body is suddenly as heavy as a wooden cross. Eric recalls his Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Almstutz, a middle-aged woman who always wore blue print dresses, black patent shoes with silver buckles, and tan pantyhose that made her legs look wooden. She didn't smile, and a tight-lipped pucker of disapproval was permanently etched onto her ruddy face. Eric's mother didn't like her very much. Mom never said so outright, but he could tell by how she referred to Mrs. Almstutz as "your teacher," and never by name. Mrs. Almstutz once spent an entire class harping on how heavy the cross was that Jesus was made to carry. She wasn't speaking metaphorically, either. She asked each of the children in the class to give a weight comparison. The other children enthusiastically compared its weight to cars, boulders, elephants, an offensive lineman for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Jabba the Hutt, and someone's overweight uncle. The kids did not take the question anywhere near as seriously as she intended. When it was Eric's turn, he was near tears and his heartbeat was a drum roll. In a regular classroom setting, Eric was composed, confident, and according to all his teachers, mature beyond his years. Sunday school was different, It wasn't the teacher that had him rattled and afraid. This was God's class. God was watching, listening, keeping track of what Eric said and did, and what he thought. Mrs. Armstutz asked Eric 3 times how much he thought the cross weighed. He thinks of the question every time he goes to church and sees the cross hanging over the altar. And every time, he remembers his answer. The 10-year-old Eric squeaked out that he couldn't imagine anything being that heavy. Andrew says, "Talk to me. How are you doing, Eric? Need me to carry her for a bit?" Eric shakes his head, not as an answer, but at the uncanny timing of Andrew's inquiries. He needs to tell Andrew what he believes might need to be done. The might is still there within him, like a crumb of conscience in an unrepentantly guilty person. But it is shrinking. He says, "I know I'm injured, concussed, not thinking straight. But what?" We continue to walk together. Our feet grind into the road at different rhythms, leaving 2 separate paths of footprints in the dirt. Eric says, "This might be real. I think it's happening." "It. Tell me what it is that's happening." Andrew wants Eric to quit obliquely referring to the other's proposal of choice and apocalyptic consequence. If Eric can be made to spell it out in detail and stop with the Midwestern polite vagueness, like how people discuss but not discuss a serious illness in the family, then Eric might understand how irrational it all is. Andrew, too, would benefit from having the illogic of what the others are proffering reinforced. In these dimming, implausible hours, he is not immune to doubt. Eric feels like he's being made to answer his Sunday school teacher's "how heavy" question all over again. He cannot explain how heavy this is. Andrew should know. He's supposed to know. Eric has too much he wants to say at once, and is unable to organize it all. What's happening to us is this big, unwieldy thing in his head, changing form and shape with each passing second. There's no beginning at the beginning. So he says, "Those planes, all crashing and crashing when they did, at the same time. Leonard said they would fall from the sky." "No, he didn't say that." "Yes, he did. He never said anything about planes. Did he ever say the word planes?" "No, but Leonard said the sky would fall into pieces. He didn't say planes. Like a scam psychic, he made a general statement, one culturally associated with end-of-the-world stories, essentially saying the sky is falling. And he let you fill in the details. What if we turned on the news and saw a skyscraper collapsing? That means the sky is falling into pieces, right? Or how about a monsoon? Or a nasty hailstorm? One could argue either of those would be closer to a literal interpretation of the sky is falling. Or it could have been a mass die-off of birds, or chunks of falling satellite, or, I don't know, space stations, goddamn Skylab 2.0 plummeting to Earth, whatever. Metaphorically, you can retrofit almost anything to, come on, Andrew. It's not much of a metaphorical leap from sky to planes. The planes literally fell out of the sky and in pieces. He said, pieces. Frankly, so what? Andrew pauses and flashes on the images of the wrecked planes, and he remembers the fear coursing through his nerves like a rabies virus, and then his giving in to the impulse to destroy the television so he wouldn't see them anymore. With as much of the voice of reason as he can muster, he adds, "Planes crash all the time." "All the time?" "Yes, they just drop like leaves in the fall. We're always having to look up and take cover and..." "All right, an exaggeration, but only a slight one. Crashes do happen frequently. It's a numbers game. There are thousands and thousands of planes all over the world in the air at any given time. The day before we drove up here, that little pond hopper crashed into a house in Duxbury. Yes, fine. But this is different than a little two-seater going down. These were commercial airplanes all crashing at the same time. You smashed the TV, but it sounded like there were more planes, maybe even all the ones in the air, and crashing right after Leonard was killed. You know, it's only occurring to me now that that's not true either. What's not true? The planes crashing after Leonard was killed. Think about the timeline here. The planes had to have crashed before Leonard died, probably at least 20 minutes or so before. What are you talking about? If the planes had crashed at the exact moment Leonard died, the news wouldn't have had enough time to gather and air the footage we saw. Video is practically instant now. Everyone has a camera. They weren't broadcasting phone videos, certainly not the flyover footage of wreckage, that plane in the ocean especially. Those crashes had to have happened before Sabrina killed Leonard. I guess so, maybe. But that's not the point. I mean, are you quibbling over the timing? The timing is pretty important, don't you think? Yes, of course, because everything Leonard said would happen did happen. And it happened each time after one of them was killed. You really think everything we've seen, everything we've been through, has been a coincidence? Andrew says, I do. As more of an affirmation to himself. They knew about the Alaskan earthquake before they came to the cabin. And then, yes, that second quake and tsunami hit was coincidental. But then they knew the pre-programmed scheduled bird flu show would be on the next morning, and had it timed to the minute with their watches, and then all those planes just happened to crash when Leonard died. They didn't crash when Andrew. Yes. Fine. A coincidence. But not an outlandish one. Maybe the planes were a pre-planned part of their narrative, too. It's possible the others were aware of reports, government warnings about terrorists, or, what did they say? Cyber attacks on planes, and we didn't hear anything because we were up here and hadn't watched TV or been on the internet for days. Even if that isn't the case, all they had to do was make us watch cable news where it's bad news all the time. Turn it on, and within minutes, you're bombarded with breaking news of wars, suicide bombings, mass shootings, trains, planes, and automobiles crashes. It doesn't work that way. They can't get that lucky with guesses and maybes, and turn on the TV and hope for something random to fit. Not like this. Think about the psychological stress and state they put us in. They break in, terrorize us, tie us up, and you seriously injure your head. Then they tell us pseudo-Christian biblical end-of-time vagaries, knowing that at any moment they can turn on the news and in our fried and frazzled brains something will very likely stick. So I believe them because I'm Catholic, right? That's so unfair, and no, Eric, no. I'm not saying that. Not trying to make you feel bad, I'm trying, and they aren't vagaries. Drowned cities, plague, sky falling into pieces. Those things happen. I know you want me to hear how preposterous it all sounds, but you should listen to yourself. You're bending yourself into a pretzel, rationalizing the impossibilities. That's just it. I'm telling you, it's not... Andrew cuts himself off and starts over. Eric, I'm gonna ask you straight out. Do you think one of us has to be killed by the other to keep the world from ending? Why would those four make it all up and make us go through this? You didn't answer mine. Jesus, Eric, the fucking guy who hate-crimed me broke into our cabin. O'Bannon and the others came here with a plan to terrorize the queers. There's your why. If it was him. Eric, I know. I'm sorry, But I'm not as sure as you are that it's the same guy. He looks different